Hi, folks. This is the CyberWays podcast, and we translate our academic knowledge about information security into stuff that you can use as a security professional. We think it's a unique mission. We think you'll like it. I'm Tom Stafford.
I'm Craig Van Slyke. Tom and I are your hosts on your journey to knowledge. CyberWays is brought to you by the Louisiana Tech College of Business's Center for Information Assurance. The center offers undergraduate and graduate certificate programs in cybersecurity and sponsors academic research focused on behavioral aspects of cybersecurity and information privacy.
Welcome back. It's CyberWays. Today we have with us an old friend, Professor Dennis Galletta from University of Pittsburgh. His research on fear appeals and security appeared in Management Information Systems Quarterly back in 2015, and he's here to talk to us about that research in managerial terms. Dennis is a professor of business administration, and he's director of the PhD program at the Katz School of Business, University of Pittsburgh. And that's a very important place in our world of IS. He's a fellow of the Association for Information Systems, also a very important recognition, and a recipient of the AIS Lifetime Achievement Award. He's past president of the AIS, that's Association for Information Systems, and he's an award-winning information systems researcher. We're lucky to have him here with us, Dennis. I'm agreed to speak to us today on short notice at that.
I'm happy to be here.
So give us the big picture. You said you had you had almost like an elevator talk for executives or something. I'm paraphrasing roughly, but you had condensed a managerial overview of this before we'd even contacted you about it.
That's right. I think that one of the things that academics do is they publish for each other. And lots of times they also have implications for practitioners. But that kind of stops there. And many times practitioners don't see our work. So I put together a practitioner summary thinking that maybe our field would rally around a flag of having a series of these practitioner summaries. It ended up that we did go on and start a series like this. These ended up being a little more brief than what I proposed, a 2-page summary, and they proposed a 3-paragraph summary. So that makes it a little bit more digestible for executives.
What's the paper all about? What did you all study?
Well, we studied how we could motivate people to be more secure. And there are many breaches that happen, and many of the breaches have to do with, of course, technologies, and some of them have to do with laws and policies, but you just have to blame users sometimes for some things that go wrong. So we started out looking at how people fail to make backups. That was our original intent for this paper, was to focus on what is it that stops people from making backups. And we looked around at different literature, and Scott Boss was doing this as a class project, actually, for a doctoral seminar. And he said he came across this theory about how people fail to protect themselves, and they need to be motivated to protect themselves. So this theory says what you have to do is you have to allow people to kind of understand what could happen more clearly. Many people think that they turn on their computer, it's going to work every time, but sometimes the hard drive will fail. Actually, it's not a matter of if your hard drive will fail. It's a matter of when it will fail, because hard drives are actually one of the specifications for hard drives is mean time between failures, which means it will fail. It has a limited lifespan. And if you handle it a bit roughly, it can fail. I have a neighbor who pounded on his keyboard one time and, surprise, surprise, his hard drive failed. Then he needed help trying to find the information to pull out to put on a new computer. And it was very difficult to do that. People don't realize how difficult it is to pull out their data. And we find backups to be a very helpful thing. But people fail to make backups. I continuously ask my students, how many of you have made a backup recently? And almost no one raises their hand, including me. So there's something that that needs to happen to motivate people. So this theory called protection motivation theory basically says that there has to be some level of fear that people have to realize that there could be something that happens to you, and that fear needs to be taken into account. And also there are ways of dodging the fear by just kind of explaining things away and saying, oh, this is going to happen to me. It won't be severe. I'm not vulnerable. And so, these things have to be taken into account. People have to realize that they are vulnerable and that the repercussions could be severe. actually some studies have found that lack of backups will lead to having to try to recover your data. There are services that do this, and the average price a few years ago was the $7,500 for trying to recover your data. So people need to realize that there is some severity to this problem and that they are vulnerable. Everyone's vulnerable if they have a device that holds data. So that needs to be a clear message for people, and they need to have some understanding that it will be rewarding to make these backups, to take the steps to be able to make backups. One of the problems with that is that many people don't know what to do or how to do it. So that represents a cost. So they almost do some kind of a calculation and say, well, what kind of benefits do I get about over making backups? And they might think, well, it's not very severe. I'm not vulnerable. So the costs end up being high. Like, how do you make a backup? What do you backup and where do you put it? And how long does it take? And those kinds of things. So you make this appraisal of how you might cope with the problem, the threat, and then you balance it out and say, okay, I'm motivated to do something. So there's a breakdown somewhere in this whole system. And that is that people need to have that fear. So that's kind of what we wanted to do, is focus on this fear and understand how we could perhaps study it and maybe impose some fear in some people and not in others, and see what happens. And we did find that fear is a powerful thing, as long as it's high enough.
Yeah, it seems like you have to change the salience of the bad things that might happen, because, you know, that's often the future. There are multiple probabilities that people have to figure out, and we are really bad at that. And so it makes sense if you can do something that triggers that, oh crap, this might happen to me. You know, it seems like it would have an effect.
That's right. And this has come out of the healthcare literature, and the healthcare has found similar things, that people just don't seem to be afraid of outcomes. And, you know, a couple examples are sitting in your dentist chair, you look at a photo on the wall, and there's a photo of someone with gum disease, and you say, oh my goodness, I really should be flossing. And somehow that fear just isn't high enough for some people. Seatbelt use was resisted and still is resisted by some people, thinking that they might be trapped in their car, in spite of data from police who say, hey, very few people suffer because of seatbelts. It's mainly the people without seatbelts that suffer. So you could think of almost any healthcare situation, including current ones, where the fear just isn't high enough from the way to protect yourself against a threat.
So Dennis, I'm sure I mentioned to you that I went to school with Jeff Tanner. And not a lot of people in our field are as read in Jeff's initial work on protection motivation theory in the medical field as they are the stuff from communications theory. But he did his dissertation on it at Georgia and got a Journal of Marketing Research hit out of it. Getting people to take an AIDS test was his experiment. And the fear stimulus is right in the middle of the AIDS epidemic. And the whole thing that came out of it, and we've talked about this several times before, is what happens if you overplay your hand and scare them too much?
Yes, that's definitely a danger. People kind of freeze up. And what often is part of that freezing up is they start to discount the problem. And you say, well, this won't happen to me. Or you say, well, I'm taking some other kinds of precautions instead. Or for instance, with smoking, some people say, there's a lot of longevity in my family, so it's not going to affect me. Or I know somebody who's 105 years old who smokes a pack a day. So people use anecdotal evidence to support their issue of whether they're going to try to cope. There are two types of, let's say, self-confidence about what you might be able to do. One of them is, do I feel like I'm competent to do what I need to do? Do I feel that I know all the steps? Do I know that I could take them accurately or precisely? And then the other one is, will what I do really make a difference? And so people have to look at that, those two types of what's called efficacy, whether it's self-efficacy, that I feel confident, or will this response even work, whether you have confidence in the response. And you subtract the impact of the costs themselves, and you say, wow, what's left over? Maybe I can't cope, or I don't know how to cope. It's just too much. And so you ignore it. Sometimes they just walk away from it and say, you know, I'll think about this tomorrow. Like many people say, I'll make a backup tomorrow. I've said that many times myself. And tomorrow never comes.
So it seems like there are two ways to attack this problem. One is to increase the perception of the likelihood of a bad thing happening or the severity, but you can also lower the bar in terms of the cost of protecting yourself. Am I hearing that correctly?
That's right. You could make it easier. And we actually did a manipulation in this paper that wasn't talked about very much, but we had some high hopes for figuring it out. It ended up only being a manipulation check, but and that is something that academics do to make sure that people notice something, or else they've given you some reliable answers. So what we did was we made it really easy for a random sample of people. One third of the people, we made it super easy. So we said, click here and the backup will be made. And it would back up their My Documents folder onto my server and encrypt it. A second group, we said, okay, so here's what you need to do. We gave them some instructions, and it was only partly automated. They had to navigate to the folders that they wanted to protect and take a backup of themselves, and then they had to click a few buttons. So it was a little bit harder. And then the third group was make a backup. Ta-da. There wasn't much with the direction that we gave them. And ended up, we also asked them to take a log, a paper log. So every day that they would make a backup, they would make an entry in their log. That didn't really help very much. The automation, amount of automation didn't help. I think if it's just done automatically by your computers, that would be the best. But what we did, we used it as a way to check up on their logs. So those people, those two thirds of the people who had this software that they were able to use, we saw that their pencil and paper logs corresponded with that. And we said, okay, we can count on these logs. And so that's really all we were able to do with that part of the manipulation.
What I wanted to ask is something essentially presaged. You were talking about your methodology, your manipulation check process. You used a concurrent protocol in the form of the logs. And it's actually a very sophisticated psychological experimental design. For our audience, who are lay-level consumers of that sort of information, give us a sense for how you put the study together.
Well, now this is just study one that I'm talking about with backups. And that actually was, we went through five versions of this paper before it was accepted. we were rejected three times, but they said, oh, you can resubmit. So we don't like this, but resubmit and fix it up. Here are some ideas. So we slowly got three reject and resubmits in a row. And we didn't want to give up.
Five rounds, you said.
Five rounds, right. But it only counts because it was a reject and resubmit. It only counted for two rounds because we had major revisions we celebrated about. And then we had conditional acceptance. So we were very happy about that. That was after we added that second study. And we also changed the way we were pitching this whole paper. But the way we put it together, the very first study, is, I think, pretty interesting. I was teaching a course, and this core course in information systems to master students, MBA students. And these master students were doing group work. So what I wanted to do is randomly select them for different ways of approaching this problem by giving them this fear that I was talking about, plus the manipulations of the different levels of automation for this. Again, that didn't work out, so that didn't end up in the paper. So let's just talk about the fear parts. I gave half the subjects high fear stories, telling them about different problems that could happen, how much it costs. And I emailed them periodically, I think it was weekly for a little while, and kept reminding them it's important to make backups. Take a look at this story. Take a look at that story. Look at the costs. And another group, I just had in class some kind of funny videos, said, yo, you need to take backups. And there's a video about somebody walking down the hall, and the person was going to run a meeting, but he smashes into a file cabinet and he's out cold. And they're talking about, you should have a backup for everything. So that's the level of the fear appeal for the other group. And basically I did say it's important to make backups, and it's very difficult to recover your data if you don't have it backed up. But I didn't go into all those more vivid kinds of fear appeals. To randomly assign them, but they're still working in groups, that presented a problem, because some of the students could communicate with each other about this. So what we had to do is do kind of a stratified randomization of randomizing the teams, making sure that they were all in the same treatment. And because we had the other treatment that for the software that we didn't do much with, it presented a little bit of a problem to try to randomly assign. But if you randomly assign subjects into one type of treatment versus another type of treatment, that becomes a true experiment when people have an equal opportunity to be in one group versus another. And having it be stratified is a little bit of a compromise on perfect randomization. But if you do, when you do an experiment, we chose an experimental approach to this. When you do an experiment, you only make one change from one group to another to control the situation and to know, because one group acts differently than another and they were randomly assigned, then you can say, well, I see one group worked better than the other, and it's because of the treatment that you gave them. The fear appeal was the only thing that was different from one group to another. So that's why we chose an experiment to be able to really isolate the fear appeal as the main differentiating factor between these groups.
So, hey, on the topic of the fear appeals, do you think there might be a half-life? Is there a fade-off effect? Do fear appeals fade over time, or do they stay consistently in mind and memory?
They do fade, and that's why we reminded them every week or two with my emails. I said, I just found another interesting statistic here. Tried to make it fairly natural, and who knows what's in the mind of the people who receives these and reads them, but they did seem to work when they had the very high fear appeal. They were more apt to pay attention and make their backups.
Wanted to probe also onto the nature of threat, or the scary thing, if you will. Craig pointed out that there was a consistent and strong link between stated intent and actual action. Behavioral intention to activity link that we're all familiar with from other studies, but that it was really robust for backups, but not so robust for malware protection. And what do you make of that? Because malware is kind of my wheelhouse. I don't want to say stunned to see that, but that's cause for concern, don't you think?
Well, I would probably blame our design a little bit for that, because I think that it may not have been very convincing. And what we were doing was we were giving them a fear appeal to click on a message to get rid of some virus that happened. And the virus had various levels of threat. I think maybe some of the people may have seen this as, this looks a little bit suspicious itself. And they may have said, I don't think I'll click on this, as another level of probably trying to prevent a threat. So I think it was muted. I think backups are very clear and very persuasive. It's very important to have backups. I do think, though, that these virus alert messages have been, even back then, some of the people may have been familiar with some of these as actual threats themselves, that say, click this to remove the backup and to remove the virus, and it actually installs the virus. So I think that was probably one of our issues there.
But it's really interesting, because if I'm reading this right, under the low fear appeal, there was a really weak relationship between intentions and actual anti-malware use. But under the high fear appeal, you were able to account for a lot of the variance in anti-malware actual use based on the intentions. And so, that fear appeal triggered something, seems to me, because, that's,
I think so,
quite high.
Yes.
Yeah.
And if we look at the sample overall, it's not a very strong relationship between the intention and the action. But in the case of the backup, I think we were able to give them enough genuine fear that they would say, yes, I'm going to actually take this action. So if you look at the overall sample, though, it kind of mutes. When you have half the people who don't get much of a fear, much fear out of it, because they don't have much of a fear appeal, then it kind of weakens their actual behavior, the connection between their intent. They may have stated an intent just to appease me as a searcher with low fear appeal. They said, I'll make them feel good and I'll have these intentions. But then when it came around to actually the action, it got diluted, I think, by The people with low fear, people with high fear, though, said, hey, I see a reason for this. And I gave them links to articles that they could read about it. And I don't know if anyone really followed up on those, but it, at least it had some backup in fact, rather than just my opinion that they should have a backup.
Our main audience is security professionals. So what should they take away from your study? What can they do at their office, at their workplace, based on what you found?
Scare the heck out of your people. No, I think that the important takeaway is that, first of all, you cannot, and I see this all the time, some IT department sees some threat and then they send a note to everybody and it says, stay away from this. Don't click on things. And then they don't hear anything for months. Meanwhile, some employees leave, some new employees come in, you have different employees, and somehow they have this mindset that, you know, I put this instruction in the computer, so the computer will do this forever. They put this instruction out to people, and the people will do this forever. No, that's not true. Many of them never even heard the message, and many of them don't really have any familiarity with what's happening. So I do think that firms should spend some time with training, spend some time showing people some examples of phishing messages, some examples of, you know, threats and how to try to avoid these threats, and also talk to them about making backups and actually go further and just have their computer be backed up, put them on the cloud and just say, you know, you're not going to store these files locally. If you want to see them again, I mean, threaten them on the other side, like a reverse blackmail, but no, tell them you really want to make sure that you use these cloud services that are very well protected and backed up. And that would be your way out of any problems with your computer. You have a computer problem, you pull in a new computer, put in your password, and you're back to what you had before. I guess the one exception is having to install everything manually. That's, unfortunately, that works very poorly with PCs. It works pretty well with mobile phones. But anyway, I think we're getting towards that. I think that vision will happen when it becomes automatic. So try to get some automaticity in there as much as possible, I think, is one message. The second one is, if you can't do that, you have to really spend time with people and make, you know, have a class of some kind. I mean, we have so many classes for various social issues. I think this is an important social issue too. It's more of a business issue, I guess, than a social issue, but it certainly is going to be expensive for firms to try to recover data that's lost. There's so much data at risk if they're on people's personal hard drives, because people don't make backups. It's just, people don't respond to fear anywhere in the world. They seem to slough it off and find reasons to put it off and to postpone and to maybe just to say it's not going to be a real problem. So we need to have this message periodically for people to see.
So it took you 5 revisions. What are you whittling on now? What's a revision 3 or revision 4? What can we look for coming down the pike from Dennis Galetta?
Well, we just finished a paper that goes beyond protection motivation theory to the extended parallel process model, which actually has a slightly different bent to it than PMT, protection motivation theory. So we decided to look at a theory that actually had a trigger point, and you could calculate a trigger point based on people's answers to some of these same questions. Some of these same variables are in the equation. Some of the same measures are in it. And what you do then is you put it together in a slightly different way and add a few other things as well, making sure that you can see social influence from other people. And you can then kind of calculate what people will do, the tipping point. And so that was just, that was accepted a few months ago in information systems research. That should be, I think it's out now, actually, at least in a pre-print form. So you can get it from the ISR website.
I'm impressed. MISQ and ISR. Now, our audience probably is aware that we have favorite journals that are impressed. And important journals and stuff like that. Dennis just mentioned the two sterling journals in our world. He's hitting them with very practical research, even though it's very theoretical as well. There's always a practical takeaway from his work.
Yeah, I actually really enjoy doing quirky kinds of studies that kind of push in a direction that people really hadn't pushed in before. but that would have, I have some intuition about, you know, something is missing, something. After you look at the literature, you find out, you know, there are a few things in here that might help, but they may not be perfectly applicable. So those are the things that we like to do. We've also just finished a fake news paper about what some of the emotions are that people feel when they look at a fake news story. And we also tell them it's fake then and measure their emotions a second time. And then we told them, okay, now imagine that people are sharing this. How do you feel now about it? And so we used an emotion questionnaire instrument that looks at 8 emotions. And please don't ask me to come up with all 8 of them, but there's anger and there's fear and there's anxiety and there's comfort. There's also happiness. And sometimes people see a political message on the opposite side that shows that they're endangered and they actually feel good about it. They have happiness and they even have desire. I really wish that this were true. I hope this is true. And so it was a very complicated mixed method study, but that's coming out in Journal of MIS, I think, next month. I just went through the galleys late last night.
That's certainly a topic for our times.
Yes, it really is.
We're going to have you come back and talk about some of this stuff.
Anytime, sure.
So, folks, it's been Dr. Dennis Galetta of University of Pittsburgh, former president of the Association for Information Systems and current photographer laureate. I forgot to mention, he is a prime photographer, best I've ever known. And that's saying something because I shoot a lot of film myself, but he's digital. Anyway, we're so glad to have Dennis here with us on Cyberways, which is brought to you by the Computer Information Systems Department of the Louisiana Tech University's College of Business. And it's a beneficiary recipient of the Just Business Grant. See you again, same time, same podcast channel.
Thank you.
And it is important to say that the Cyberways podcast is funded through the Just Business Grant program of the Louisiana Tech College of Business. And we're grateful for that.
So join us next time on the Cyberways podcast, which is available on all major podcast platforms. We want you to subscribe or follow or whatever button your favorite podcast app has. Thank you very much.